I'm Tracy Sable tonight on EWTN News Nightly, home stretch. Vice President Harris and former President Trump head into the final weekend on the campaign trail. We hear what they have to say. Voting block. Some surprising data suggests half of the nation's people of faith do not plan to cast a ballot in the election. We have analysis from the Heritage Foundation's Kevin Roberts. The fight for life. A look at an effort in West Virginia to approve the first constitutional prohibition against assisted suicide and euthanasia. Plus, canonization process. Pope Francis tells the faithful to take little steps each day when striving for holiness. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the Solemnity of All Saints. Our top story tonight, the white-hot campaign spotlight shining tonight on Wisconsin. Both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are headed to the swing state. Their travels come just 4 days before the election and just hours after the latest jobs report revealing a lower-than-expected number that the Trump campaign criticized while President Joe Biden offers his own assessment. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports. Owen.
That's right, Tracy. Remember, in poll after poll, the economy, a huge factor heading into the election next Tuesday. And today, a surprisingly weak jobs report from the U.S. Labor Department. America's employers added just 12,000 jobs in October. That's far less than the 115,000 analysts predicted.
The final jobs report before Election Day is out. Immediately, the Trump campaign pounces, sending off this blistering critique, writing, "The jobs report is a catastrophe and definitively reveals how badly Kamala Harris broke our economy." President Joe Biden, headed towards Marine One today on his way to Pennsylvania, did not stop to talk to reporters, but earlier released his own statement on the October jobs report, writing in part, "The devastation from Hurricanes Helene and Milton and new strike activity lower job growth. Job growth is expected to rebound in November as our hurricane recovery and rebuilding efforts continue." Meanwhile, today, Harris and Trump go after each other again.
"All I can tell you is she's an inferior candidate. She shouldn't be running. She didn't get one vote. She is totally an inferior candidate. She shouldn't be running."
Trump is increasingly, however, someone who considers his political opponents the enemy, is permanently out for revenge, and is increasingly unstable and unhinged.
On the campaign trail in battleground Michigan, GOP vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance tells supporters,
"My friends, we're thrilled to be here. We have got just 4 days to go, 4 days to turn Michigan red, and 4 days to make Donald J. Trump the next president of the United States, and we're going to do it."
Also in Michigan, Democratic vice presidential nominee Tim Walz.
"I don't know if you know or not, but the election's 4 days away. So you are as happy as I am about that. But look, what a privilege. This election will shape generations to come. I think we know that."
Now, later tonight, Harris and Trump both zeroing in on the battleground state Wisconsin, both holding rallies in the Milwaukee area. Milwaukee, home to the most Democratic votes in that state, but its conservative suburbs are where most Republicans live. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
After analysis, we turn now to Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics. Tom, great to have you back on. A lot to discuss, but first, I want to talk about the jobs report, and rather dismal one at that. What type of impact do you think this could have on the election, if at all, at this point?
I think a lot of this is already sort of baked in the cake. I mean, obviously, it's not great news for the Harris campaign. They'd rather would have had that be a better number. But, like, I mean, 50 million people have already voted. A lot of people have already made up their minds about this campaign well before today. For those people who are still out there and undecided, maybe it'll move a couple of them. I mean, the polls do suggest that the economy is the number one issue by far. And this is another sign that this economy is not as great for average Americans as the Harris campaign would like them to believe. So it's not great news, but I'm not sure it's going to have a major impact in this race.
Yeah, as Owen just mentioned, today both presidential candidates are in Wisconsin and both vice presidential candidates are in Michigan. Tom, how crucial are those states?
Well, look, I mean, if you look at those seven battleground states where this race is going to be decided, Trump has moved out to almost a 3-point lead in Georgia. almost a 3-point lead in Arizona. He's up a point and a half in North Carolina, and he's up about a point and a half in Nevada, according to our averages. So that leaves the upper Midwest as Kamala Harris's best and perhaps only route to winning this race. She's got to win Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. She's ahead in two of those three states. She's got a 0.3% lead, which is obviously within the margin of error in Wisconsin. She's up about 0.8% in Michigan. Trump's leading by about 0.5% in Pennsylvania. So all three of those states are really, really close. If she wins them all, she becomes president. She wins 270, 268. If she loses any one of those three, Donald Trump's going to be president.
Yeah, you mentioned Pennsylvania. And in the latest USA Today Suffolk poll, they have Trump and Harris tied there in the Keystone State. For those voters, Tom, that don't have their minds made up yet there, what do you think the candidates need to do to win their support, especially in PA?
I mean, if you're undecided at this point in the race, some of these people won't vote. I mean, they just won't. They weren't turning out. Maybe they're telling pollsters they will. And the campaigns are, obviously they're trying to reach their hardcore partisans. And then the next task is to work their way down to some of these voters that are lower propensity voters, the ones who, maybe they didn't vote last time or the time before that, and try and get them to the polls. And again, each campaign has their arguments. Trump's focused on the economy, immigration. Harris is focused on abortion and Trump's sort of fitness for office. It's not clear. As I said, we have 17 polls in our Real Clear Politics average in Pennsylvania, and 12 of them have this race at 1 point or less. So it's literally that close, and both sides are sort of fighting tooth and nail for every last vote there.
Yeah, I know. Quickly, I want to get to this from Real Clear Polling. I know you find, for the first time in his political career, with less than 1 week until the election, former President Trump holds the lead in Real Clear's national average. Tom, take us through the numbers, if you will, and how they compare to the past elections in 2020 and 2016.
Yeah, I mean, this entire campaign, Trump has been running well ahead of where he was 4 years ago and 8 years ago. Now, if you remember, in the Hillary Clinton campaign of 2016, that race tightened at the very end. She ended up finishing about 3 points ahead of Donald Trump. She ended up winning it by 2 points. And Biden was ahead by over 7.5 points, and he ended up winning by 4.5. So in nationally and in these battleground states, Donald Trump is well ahead of where he was in the past two campaigns. That's a good sign if you're the Trump campaign, and that if the polls are accurate, this race is going to be razor close. Now, the Trump campaign and Trump supporters like to say, well, his vote was underestimated in 2016. It was underestimated in 2020. It's going to happen again. We don't know if that's true or not, but certainly, as I said, he's in a better position than he's ever been.
Yeah, Tom, thank you so much for weighing in. Always appreciate it.
Thanks, Tracy.
Well, it is the most expensive political race in Maryland history. Tens of millions of dollars are being spent in the battle for a Senate seat. Former Republican Governor Larry Hogan, a Catholic, is facing Democrat Angela Alsobrooks, an executive from a county just outside of the nation's capital. Both candidates support abortion.
Your folks that are listening to this interview, it's an important issue to them. I'm a lifelong Catholic, and I've got my own personal views about abortion, but I've always said I'm not going to be able to make that decision for anyone else, and I'm not going to stand between a woman and her doctor.
I'll continue to fight on behalf of Maryland, women in Maryland, to make sure that we are preserving that freedom, as well as the right to access contraception, the right to access IVF. And we realize that the Republican Party has essentially declared war on the reproductive freedoms of Marylanders.
The Catholic Church's voter guide lists abortion and life issues as the first of its seven pillars. Control of the U.S. Senate may be determined by this race. And according to recently released campaign numbers, both parties and political action groups have poured in more than $85 million. Reaching across the aisle is something both candidates say they can make happen.
I'm not a very partisan guy. I'll work with anyone who wants to do the people's business, but I've always been able and willing to reach across the aisle to come up with kind of that fine common ground for the common good, which I think most Catholic voters probably would like to see more of that in Washington, where, frankly, there's not that kind of leadership.
I believe it's going to be important for the Democratic Party to remain in control of the Senate, to reflect the will of the average Marylander who believes that the privacy and freedom that women deserve in terms of having their own health care decisions.
According to Real Clear Politics, also Brooks maintains a steady lead. Marylanders will also be voting whether to enshrine abortion into the state constitution. And as we draw closer to Election Day, a new study examines how many people of faith plan to cast a ballot, and the findings may just surprise you. According to Arizona Christian University, just 51% of people of faith are expected to vote in this year's presidential election, and 52% said they felt their vote would not make a difference. The most common reason for not voting, 68% of people polled said they had a lack of interest in politics and elections. 57% said they disliked the major candidates, and nearly half think the election results will be manipulated. Well, joining us now to talk more about this is Dr. Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation. Dr. Roberts, great to be with you today. I know you took part in a roundtable discussion that touched on this very study. Were you at all surprised by the results?
No, I'm not surprised by the results, although I will say a year ago I would have been. In other words, one of the things I've learned this year, Tracy, is how few people of faith, even regular churchgoers, vote. And so one of the things we've been trying to do in our enterprise, Heritage Foundation, Heritage Action in particular, is motivate people of faith to get out to the polls and remember they have a moral obligation to do so.
Absolutely. And tell us why that is so very important.
Well, it's important all the time. One of the reasons that Western civilization, driven by Christianity, as you know, has been so successful in protecting the freedoms of people is because people of faith go out and they lean into institutions, including the institution that is our voting system. It's particularly important this year, too, not to get into partisan politics, which don't interest you or me, but to think about the contrasting philosophies of the major candidates for presidency. However someone votes, their involvement in the voting process means that they're going to be more involved in other institutions in their life. And if they do that, and they're people of faith, then our schools, our churches, our professional associations are a lot more vibrant.
Yeah, we also mentioned that a large portion of people polled weren't planning on voting because they said they didn't like either of the two major candidates. Dr. Roberts, what would you say to Catholics and other people of faith who maybe feel this way?
I've spoken to a lot of Catholics and a lot of Christians who have felt that way. And I've, number one, told them, study the issues. And when you study the issues that are particularly important to us as people of faith, the life issue, the health of the family, religious liberty, the vice president's policy record on that, I'm just speaking about her official office and her policy record the last 3.5 years, is deplorable. It really is. And so as people of faith, we have to weigh that policy record and put it into the future and understand that if she were to win, that we are going to see threats to religious liberty. We're going to see threats to our ability to worship. We will continue to pray for her as the president of the United States, obviously, but we really do need to consider that in the next days, particularly if there are Catholics and other Christians who are thinking they might just stay home.
Was there anything else from the study that really stood out to you?
Well, one of the things about the study that I think is striking to me is that we have an amazing distrust of institutions, including among us as people of faith. And one of the ways that we can correct that, although it's going to take a generation, is to make sure that we're doing things like voting, we're talking to neighbors, we're actually engaged in civil discourse, even if we might have differences of opinion. If we can recapture that, Tracy, particularly as people of faith, that I'm very optimistic about the future of America.
Almost out of time, but I quickly want to talk about Project 2025, which the Harris Walz ticket and many other Democrats have attributed to former President Trump. In fact, Vice President Harris mentioned it just the other night when she was speaking here in the nation's capital to try and mobilize her base and sway undecided voters. Dr. Roberts, set us straight here about Project 2025 and whose initiative it is and actually what it says and what it doesn't say.
Sure. Well, this is something Heritage has done since 1980 for whoever the winner would have been. In that case, President Reagan, as you know. It's policies and personnel that the next president and vice president get to determine if they're going to use. The decision is theirs. But the second thing is, and it gets into the sort of political season we're in, Tracy, the vice president can't run on her record because she's opened the border, she's wrecked the economy, she's undermined religious liberty. And so she has to run by mischaracterizing the work of the entire center right of the United States. And ultimately, if I were to make a prediction, she's going to be unsuccessful in having done so. And we're always going to do this work because this is the kind of work that think tanks do.
Well, Dr. Roberts, great to be with you. Thank you so much. God bless.
Thanks for having me.
A dozen of people are dead following an Israeli airstrike in northeastern Lebanon. Israel has stepped up airstrikes against the terror group Hezbollah as it targets larger urban areas. This comes as Palestinians recover bodies following a barrage of strikes on central Gaza that began Thursday. Israel says that it was targeting infrastructure near a refugee camp. And we have a lot more still to come here on EWTN News Nightly, including a life-changing vote. Voters in West Virginia will decide on a measure that would be a first in the fight against assisted suicide. And why pro-lifers will not be able to protest outside of abortion facilities in the UK. National buffer zone law prohibiting protests outside of abortion facilities in the United Kingdom is now in effect. The measure makes it a criminal offense to demonstrate within around 500 feet of an abortion facility. Officials add that silent prayer is, quote, not necessarily a crime. Pro-lifers call the law a national disgrace.
I have heard from hundreds of women who were having abortions because they felt it was the only option available. Not a single one has ever said to me they were aware of the alternatives or of the risk or complications.
A punishment for violating the law is up to 6 months in prison and unlimited fines. The government in Quebec is allowing assisted suicide, that is, for individuals who cannot consent at the time of the procedure. One pro-life advocate calls the move, quote, dehumanizing, adding it devalues those with diminished mental abilities. A government website says the measure applies to those with a serious and incurable illness like Alzheimer's disease. And back here in the United States, when it comes to the election, there is more at stake than the White House and control of Capitol Hill. Voters in West Virginia are considering a measure that would add a constitutional amendment banning assisted suicide. Amendment 1 would be the first constitutional prohibition in any state against assisted suicide and euthanasia. Among those supporting the initiative are State Delegate Pat McGeehan and assisted suicide prevention expert Alex Schadenberg. The Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston also supports the proposal, with Bishop Mark Brennan encouraging the state's faithful to vote for the amendment. Assisted suicide is legal in several states, including California, Colorado, Hawaii, Maine, Montana, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, and in Washington, D.C. And for more, we turn now to Kayla Kessinger, former West Virginia State Delegate and pro-life advocate. Kayla, good to be with you today. We appreciate you coming on. As mentioned, assisted suicide is legal in several states and here in the District of Columbia. However, in West Virginia, it seems many want to go a much different route. Talk to us about that and more about Amendment 1.
Yeah, so, you know, in West Virginia, we understand that every life is sacred, that all life has value, and that it's not only just something to be protected, but it's actually something that we should be fighting for. And that's exactly what we're trying to do with Amendment 1. We are taking the fight to the death lobby. The gloves are coming off, and we're not going to wait for them to sneak their way into our borders and bring their message of death. Instead, we're going on the offense. We are planning on stopping them in their tracks and really telling them that their message of death has no place here in the Mountain State, not here, not now, not ever. And ultimately, our goal is to ensure that every generation of West Virginian, both now and in the future, are protected against the evils of assisted suicide and make sure that our children and our children's children don't have to grow up in a state where life is considered disposable.
Yeah, and Kayla, we mentioned that the Diocese of Wheeling-Charleston and Bishop Mark Brennan have really been outspoken in supporting this pro-life initiative. What have you heard from other church leaders?
Yeah, you know, I could not be more grateful for Bishop Brennan and the leadership that he's shown on this issue and every issue that has to do with the sanctity of human life. As I've traveled the state and had the opportunity to talk with faith leaders, members of the faith community across denominations, what I'm hearing is that as Christians, as followers of Jesus, we understand that we are image bearers of Christ and that it is important to protect life whether it's at its earliest stages in the womb or at the end of life, whether it's for our disabled, our veterans, our elderly, that we understand and recognize that our faith leads us and guides us to a point of protecting and fighting for the sanctity of life.
Kelly, I know you're going around the state. Any sense of how this may go?
Yeah, I feel incredibly optimistic. You know, as every conversation that I have, it's so interesting because a lot of people aren't aware that groups like Death with Dignity and Compassion and Choices have made it abundantly clear that they want nothing more than for every American to be able to access assisted suicide in every state across the country. But then when I get to share with them that passing Amendment 1 means that West Virginia becomes the first jurisdiction, I think, in the world that I'm aware of, to place a prohibition in our Constitution, they understand that that means we're refusing to allow this industry of death to open up shop in West Virginia. And we as West Virginians find it offensive that there are groups out there that want to insinuate that our aging loved ones, our veterans, the disabled, that their mere existence is nothing more than a burden. In West Virginia, we know that we care about our most vulnerable. We care about each other. That's what makes West Virginia's culture so different and so unique. And it's something that we want to protect. And passing Amendment 1 really does allow us to continue to place our flag in the ground and tell the world that we know what true compassion is. And it's not killing our loved ones faster. It's walking with them in their time of deepest need, sacrificing our own comfort so that they can recognize and understand that they're not a burden and that their life has always and will always have value.
Okay, Kayla, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us and telling us what is at stake here. We appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, changing their tune. Missouri Bishop Sean McKnight makes a major decision about the use of some contemporary church hymns. Plus, we say halo to a beloved church figure who was ordained on All Saints Day back in 1946. In Missouri is banning several contemporary hymns from being sung at Mass. The Diocese of Jefferson City says the songs have doctrinal inaccuracies in their lyrics. Church leaders also banned music by three contemporary Catholic composers who have been accused of misconduct. Pope Francis says the faithful are encouraged to ask God for the gift of a holy life.
Il Signore sostenga chi soffre e chi porta soccorso.
On a special dress for the Solemnity of All Saints, the Holy Father says holiness is attainable, and it can happen with simple little steps every day. He also highlighted a characteristic of the saints, saying they are people filled with God who are incapable of remaining indifferent to the needs of their neighbor. And as we mentioned earlier, today is the Solemnity of All Saints, and on this day in 1946, one of the most beloved church figures in recent history was ordained to the priesthood. EWTN Vatican journalist Benedict Sittigren has more.
Do not be afraid. Open your hearts, open up your hearts to Christ. The deepest joy there is in life is the joy that comes from God.
Karol Wojtyła's path to priesthood was filled with danger. He began his theological studies in secret due to Nazi occupation. When he was ordained a priest on All Saints' Day in 1946, the war was over, but Poland remained under a Soviet-backed communist regime. In 1995, Pope John Paul II said that this difficult situation matured his priestly vocation.
He was a man of prayer, dedicating every free moment when he wasn't working to prayer. Sometimes, even while dictating his texts, he would close his eyes briefly and pause. And I can see that he was praying, deeply immersed.
Throughout his life in papacy, the Polish Pope consistently emphasized the importance of the universal call to holiness, urging all to grow closer to God in their daily lives. In his teachings, John Paul II emphasized that holiness involves surrendering to God and trusting in his goodness. But above all, he stressed that holiness demands prayer, the intimate dialogue with the one who is calling you to be his disciples.
He had kind of a geography of prayer. meaning that each day he would pray for a particular part of the church or a particular community, always trying to recall what each community was experiencing. Bishops who came for visits were sometimes surprised at how up-to-date the Holy Father was regarding the details of their community's life.
Even with his remarkable qualities, this great saint is remembered as a simple man.
He was a very simple, kind, warm-hearted, sensitive, and compassionate man, and that truly captivated us. Of course, being part of his prayers encouraged us to stay devoted and supportive. Yet we saw him more as a father than as a saint.
Even in his final days, St. John Paul II remained steadfast, enduring great physical suffering to stay close to people and spread God's love. At his funeral, millions of people cried out Santo Subito, meaning Saint Now in Italian. Convinced that he continues to watch over and pray for all of humanity on their path to holiness from the window of the Father's house. In Rome, Benedictia de Grian, EWTN News Nightly.
And we thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Tracy Sable. Good night, and God bless.